Good morning.
Well, I just want to start by saying that you know that the governor's not here by the fact that I'm here. But I do want to mention that we just launched Monday the new eMaryland Marketplace Advantage to replace the legacy, and I see Bob Gleason in the back there, and I would like to just commend Bob and the entire team. Bob is our senior procurement executive, works within the Department of General Services, and has been leading the charge with our reforming and modernizing our procurement process, but also in implementing the new eMaryland Marketplace. And so from what I have heard, and Bob, you can correct me, there has been very little, if any, difficulties in this transition. Some of the, I guess, you know, more people awareness and getting used to the new system, but it is something that brings us into at least this century where we were in the last century or decade before. And I want to thank Bob and all those, Sachin and Jamie and all those who were involved in that. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
With that, I'd like to turn it over to the treasurer for any comments.
Well, it's good to be here. There's a big agenda and some difficult issues I look forward to dealing with, and hope we can arrive at a good conclusion. I do have to say I just returned from a very intense weekend in New Jersey at my grandson's first birthday and 2 days of babysitting, so it's a pleasure.
That can be
to
very
be
intense.
Here.
Yeah. Very intense. Usually the first birthday, if I can recall, the 1 year old really doesn't understand what's going on. Uh-huh. It's all about the parents and the grandparents.
Absolutely.
It's their celebration. And celebration of, you know, what has taken place over the last year, and maybe they're getting a little bit more sleep. So
that's hope.
Mr. Comptroller.
Yes, thank you, Lieutenant Governor and Madam Treasurer, and glad to announce that James Francho Borak was born 2 days ago. My He's totally clueless, I can tell you that. So hats off to everyone, and delighted to be here. Did want to comment on the fact that my hometown was involved in a controversy recently. This is Tacoma Park, where I've lived for 40 years, raised my family there. It's a wonderful community. I had the privilege of representing Tacoma Park for 20 years in the legislature and now 13 years as comptroller. It is my home. I've always found it to be a city of welcoming and inclusion. As a Tacoma Park resident and as a taxpayer, I was very troubled by the city government's decision to sponsor a showing of an anti-Semitic documentary and a panel discussion that included an individual, this was last night, who was publicly called for the destruction of the State of Israel. I'm extremely disappointed that notwithstanding the objections and concerns expressed by many residents of Tacoma Park and elected officials in Montgomery County, the city decided to move forward with the film and the panel discussion as part of the, if you can believe it, quote, We Are Tacoma, unquote, series. I'm fine with freedom of speech and political expression. I'm not fine with local government using tax dollars to peddle the same bigoted dog whistles that have been used to rationalize hatred, discrimination, and violence against the Jewish people for hundreds and hundreds of years. In a time when our political discourse is plunged into the lowest levels of incivility, when racism and bigotry are common themes in tweets coming out of the White House, when religions are being used as weapons of hate and division, I would have hoped that the leaders of Tacoma Park would have exercised better judgment than sponsoring an event featuring a film produced with malice and hate against the Jewish community. Indeed, the critical ingredient to this nation's greatness is the diversity of our people. It's my hope that moving forward, communities across Maryland and across our country will find more opportunities to celebrate our differences instead of widening the fault lines that exist within our nation today. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
No, it's a pleasure. Very well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very well said. Thank you very much. Before we get to the Secretary's agenda, two quick things. Madam Secretary, what we're going to do is after your agenda, we're going to take transportation first, followed by Department of Information Technology, because the good Secretary, who I think is a little crazy, had knee surgery last week, and has limped in here, I guess trying to be a trooper, but he really should be at home. But that's just my opinion. But before we get to those, I have one more announcement, a series of announcements. We want to recognize some longtime Department of Transportation employees. I want to mention them in order, or in this order that I have. Michael Bailey is a project engineer who has worked for State Highway for 54 years. He's a graduate of Baltimore City Junior College, so you know that was a few years ago when they were still calling them junior colleges. He started as a lab technician at the State Roads Commission, also tells you that was a few years ago, eventually progressing into inspection and project engineering roles on construction projects, and currently serves as office engineer in the State Highways District Office here in Annapolis. Michael, thank you very much for your service. And as I go through, everyone will bring you up and others for a presentation of a citation. Also, we're recognizing Roy Cannon. Roy is a right-of-way agent who has been with State Highway for a mere 50 years. Roy has worked on numerous projects such as I-70 and Maryland 100. Throughout his career, Roy has met hundreds of landowners adjacent to roadways and road projects. Roy's vast institutional knowledge has helped respond to and secure federal assistance in Ellicott City during those flooding events. Also, and I hope I pronounce your name correctly, Leondis Session is a dispatcher who has worked for Maryland Transit Administration for also 50 years. Lee served in the Army until 1967 when he started driving for the Baltimore Transit Company, again dating himself, now known as Maryland Transportation Administration. After taking a break to attend Morgan State, he returned in 1969 and worked as an operator for 13 years and a dispatcher for 37 years and counting. Lee says that he looks forward to many more beautiful days at MTA. And Nancy, and I hope I get your name correct, Olhoff has been a toll collector for the Maryland Transportation Authority for 50 years. Nancy has spent her entire career working at the Bay Bridge, greeting countless travelers. She met her husband when he was a police officer assigned to the bridge, and keeping things in the family, Nancy's daughter, Catherine Burkhart, or Bankart, who is also here today, began her career with the Transportation Authority before eventually moving to the Secretary's Office of Department of Transportation. And I understand Nancy at one point had to board buses and count the individuals on the bus. Is that true? Where's Nancy?
That's true.
So those were the days of charging per person to go across the bridge. It wasn't as much traffic back then, I guess. So, if everyone can come up, we have citations.
come around this way. There's a
Michael has to back up.
Talking about MDOT, and I noticed the former deputy secretary. President, I came from an appointment with MVA this morning at 9 o'clock to get one of those updated license, driver's licenses. And I want to say it was on Harry S. Truman Parkway in Annapolis. Yes. The people there were so efficient, friendly. It just was a really good operation. I just want to.
Yeah.
We don't hear that.
Yes, Mr.
Yes, there is a very big difference in what is happening at MVA.
Well organized.
The employees are very helpful and courteous and seem happy to be there. And so that's nice. One more thing, and I just, when seeing Secretary Ports or Administrator Ports now, congratulations, Jim Ports, who is the Executive Director of Maryland Transportation Authority. Congratulations to you. Big job. Now, which toll booth are you? But I also want to say that Jim and I had the pleasure yesterday of watching real football at the Redskins FedEx Stadium, Real Madrid versus Arsenal. Real Madrid won on penalty kicks. I know everyone is fascinated about that. And so it was a wonderful, wonderful time there. So, Madam Secretary.
Good morning, Governor West. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 17 items on the agenda this morning. 3 reports of emergency procurements. We're withdrawing item 5, which will come back later.
This is just a matter of curiosity on my part, and, it's in the public record. Item 3, the wetlands license, Anne Arundel County, you don't need to come up. Is this Norm Mineta, the former Secretary of Transportation?
It is.
Great.
Mr. Morganti, the Wetlands Administrator, prepared the item, and when I saw it going into the agenda editing, I was like, that's Norm Mineta.
I thought he went back to California, so he's a Marylander paying taxes here. Thank you, Norm Mineta. Okay.
And he is a bipartisan cabinet secretary. He served under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush.
Yes, he is cabinet secretary and former longtime congressman from Northern California. Item number 7. This is the net zero single family. And number eight, I see the secretary is here. Secretary Holt, good morning.
Good morning.
This is very interesting, program. I see that we're providing a loan, which is second to, I guess, their construction loan. My concern with it is just how many people are actually aware of the program. You know, when I look at a multi-million-dollar or million-dollar construction home, the average Joe, with the exception of Montgomery County, of course, can't necessarily afford that type of purchase or construction. It's just I would imagine we don't have an income cutoff per se, but how are we making people aware of this, that a moderate-priced person who wants to buy a home or build a home can apply for this type of assistance?
Well, good morning. I'm Ken Holt, Secretary of the Department of Housing and Community Development. I appreciate your interest in net zero. From the standpoint of marketing and branding, that looks like you on the cover there. We are doing a very good job through our website and with collateral that's available when we go out to conferences and conventions to talk about net zero. The program, from a standpoint of general fund appropriation, was sort of reduced pretty significantly. And we decided 2 years ago to try to put focus and attention and some capital behind it. We had a $500,000 general fund appropriation. That is being used in 9 units that are being constructed in Talbot County. These are going to be moderate to low-income units.
Yeah, that's item 8.
And that's the next item. So basically we have 10 that we're addressing now. Last year we provided significant capital for the construction of 75 units of veterans housing at Perry Point. That also it was about a $23 million construction project. We used about $1.4 million to create a solar farm so that veterans would have either no electric cost or a very reduced electric cost. So in 2017, we had one project in, I think, Mount Rainier. In 2018, we had 75 units in Perry Point. And then this year, we're trying to expand regionally across the state. So we have these two opportunities. There is no income requirement. The purpose of it is really to try to get developers, contractors, to understand the construction of net zero housing and to participate in it. And in this particular Montgomery County instance, we have a very enthusiastic buyer who is putting substantial amount of their personal means into a mortgage, and we're providing a loan of $143,000 to provide geothermal and solar to help reduce the energy consumption in that particular house. It's a great program. I think it ought to be expanded. We're using some regional gas house initiative money called REGI money to help grow this program in addition to our general fund appropriation, which is modest. So I think that this is really a very good beginning and allows us to gain some momentum with the program.
So the marketing is primarily to developers. In the case of the multifamily in Talbot County, it's their local housing authority, housing commission.
The local housing authority in partnership with a developer called Flywheel, and I think it's a very good sort of union of public and private interests. In the case of Montgomery County, that individual looking through our website saw the program and became very enthusiastic about the program and about essentially acquiring property, demolishing an existing house, and building a net zero structure there. Mm-hmm. So from what I understand from him, this program incentivized his construction of a net zero home.
Okay. And what is the interest rate we charge on the second?
The interest rate is 2%, and that's okay. It really is a range 2, 3, or 4%, and it's driven by the amount of energy savings And in this case, it's essentially near zero. In other words, the consumption of energy in the house is being offset by energy that is being generated into the grid to create net zero energy impact.
Okay. Very good. Hopefully after, if this item, the two items are approved, you'll put out a press release, and maybe our friends in the media will help get that information out, because I'm just not sure a lot of people are aware of this. You know, this individual, like you said, he or she went on the website and found it, but this is a person like that's really investing in a home that's going to have a substantial value above what a lot of people can pay for.
I completely agree. And this individual was subsequently elected to the planning board in Montgomery County, and I think his enthusiasm for the program hopefully will be reflected in his promoting it as a member of the planning council.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
No, I have to say I have the same question, Ken. I think it sounds like a great program, and we should be pushing it, and we should be funding it.
Yep.
It's in the state's interest. It's in everyone's interest. But I would hope that the primary function would not be to help those who obviously have capacity way beyond even the typical person in Montgomery County.
Yeah. I think that's very fair, but, you know, our programs essentially are designed to assist any individual,
But the question is, the more people know about it, the larger range of people you have in the pool, you're actually not going to be able to service everybody, I hope. And there has to be some understanding of priorities, which I assume will be getting as many houses net zero as possible. Dwellings.
Absolutely. We agree, and I think we're pushing it very aggressively now. And this is sort of a launching pad, these 10 units. So.
Yeah. That's great. And the fact that it's all over the state.
Exactly.
Talbot County,
Montgomery County. Exactly. If I could take a moment of personal privilege and address the comptroller, I just want to tell you that, you know, all of us are shaped, I think, by the support and love that we get from our mothers and our fathers. And this is best expressed when they come and attend in the audience ball games, concerts, spelling bees, things that we do as children. And there was not one single Board of Public Works meeting that I attended that your father was not sitting in the front row. And he was a great credit to you and you to him.
Very good.
And now we have Jack Francho.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Move approval.
Second. And all in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Treasurer Cobb, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, Comptroller Francho.
Give a second.
Sure. Good morning. For the record, my name is Earl Lewis, Deputy Secretary with the Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation has 27 items to present to you today. As a side note, six of these are small business reserve contracts, procurements totaling nearly $10 million. And we have representatives available to answer any questions.
Well, I do have questions about the Small Business Reserve Program or the contracts. I was looking at 20M, and if I follow my little pages correctly, it's followed by 21. The others in there, and I really appreciate the fact that the Transportation State Highway is utilizing the Small Business Reserve Program. I do want to stress, and I'm going to raise this when the university system comes up, because they have a procurement in the Small Business Reserve, is that We can award contracts at a higher dollar value to the small businesses. They can do beyond the, you know, $700,000 contract. So, you know, I encourage you and the other agencies to talk to their procurement officers in terms of doing their due diligence to see that some of these businesses can do higher value contracts. Because one of the challenges that we have with the Small Business Reserve is that there are small businesses that just say, well, I'm not sure why I should even worry about it because I can compete on the fair and open, and they can do fair and open, but the Reserve also encourages them to utilize this program. One question on 23, Kim. The contractors listed as an award, Outdoor Contractors, Inc., of Hancock, and then the bid says Outdoor Contractors, Inc., of Williamsport. Is that a mistake, or is that two different locations? Or?
Right here. I believe we have a representative from State Highway. I'm going to guess that's a mistake.
Tis.
Yes, we'll fix that. Thank you.
All right. Okay. See, I read these things.
Oh, I know you do.
Okay. Any other questions on transportation's agenda?
I had a question on item 27. This is a request from the Department of Transportation to award or modify 5 master contract task orders totaling $1.5 million. One I'm concerned about is a $297,000 single bid contract to Reinhardt Railroad Construction. Typically, I vote against single bid contracts. This is for minor safety-related improvements. According to MTA, the 2 non-bidding master contractors were only interested in bidding on track-specific work, but looking at the item documents, it indicates that the work is for light rail track rehabilitation. I would like the administrator, if he's here, to just explain why this was a single-bid project.
Yes, both Joe Sedtall and also Kevin Quinn are both here.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, my name is Kevin Quinn. I'm the Administrator of Maryland Transit Administration. I'm going to turn it over to Joe to discuss specifically the single bid issue.
For the record, my name is Joe Sedtall. I'm Director of Procurement at the MTA. Regarding this particular single bid, the name of the contract is Ancillary Metro and Light Rail Track Rehabilitation. But the scope of work allows for minor repairs and maintenance associated and surrounding the track as well. So the scope of work does allow for beyond just straight, as you think about it, track work. Regarding the single bid issue in particular, we did contact both of the other vendors that did not bid, and we received responses for why they didn't bid on this particular project. On this project, one of the vendors said that at the time they just had too much of a workload and weren't able to send people out and perform on this job, so they didn't bother bidding. And another vendor said that at the time, when this bid was put out, that they wanted to only do track-specific work. And there was also an element of at the time when the work was being performed, which is over the weekend and at night, that they had a concern about having people out at that time. So they chose not to bid. Obviously, per your point, this isn't something that we want to have happen, and we always try as much as we can to avoid it. I think this is largely a result of a single bid occurring of the timing of when the procurement occurred versus anything related to the contract itself or the procurement.
Okay. Since you're up there, Mr. Administrator, let me just ask about the 14 light rail stops that MTA intends to shut down for 3 weeks of maintenance. Obviously, everyone is a little bit on edge. This sinkhole, I think it's the granddaddy of all potholes, I guess, up in the city. That is obviously going to continue to impact mass transit in general. And I guess that some of the local press reports up in the city talk about your detailed plans for additional closure and disruptions to the light rail service. I understand what you're after, which is safety for the passengers, but are you confident that you're going to be able to make these repairs within a 3-week time period?
Yeah, so let me just address the two issues that are kind of at play here. So The first is the city's infrastructure, the water main, followed by heavy flooding about 2.5 weeks ago at the corner of Howard and Pratt Streets. So as a result of heavy flooding, there was a lot of dirt, of earth that was removed from under the street that resulted in this massive granddaddy, great-great-granddaddy of a sinkhole. And so as a result, that's directly adjacent to the light rail tracks. So we can't safely run trains there at that time, but that's not that's a city infrastructure project, and so they're working on that. Simultaneously, further north, up around the Cold Spring area, we have been planning for around a year now to do a 3-week planned maintenance that just so happens to be during this time right now, and that's to address some rail replacement issues, some erosion issues adjacent to the tracks, some catenary, some tree trimming, things like that that are further north. So unfortunately what's happened here is between the sinkhole downtown and this planned maintenance that we need to get done for the safety of our passengers, we now have a bus bridge that's going roughly from Lutherville, starting tomorrow it'll be from Falls Road down to Camden Station with express and local buses. To your exact question, we are on schedule to meet that 3-week timeline. I can't speak to the city's timeline with regard to the sinkhole and the impact on their infrastructure and whether that will be complete in the same timeline. If that's not complete, we will still have a bus bridge operation in place.
Okay, but you have an alternative mass transit service. That's excellent. And if you could just keep us informed about what exactly the schedule for the closure is being lifted, because obviously they're critical to the great city of Baltimore.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is not like the D.C. Metro situation where they closed the various Virginia stations because of problems with the platform. So I think they closed the rest of the summer, as a matter of fact. But they also are offering bus service. For those of you coming from Virginia or staying in Virginia. Okay.
If anyone sees Paul Wiedefeld, give him my best. No good deed goes unpunished in, over there with Metro. But thank you for that. Move approval unless the treasurer has any
questions on consultation. I think we have a second, and we're all in favor. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now we go to Department of Information Technologies.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Michael Leahy, MAG
Secretary.
Michael,
one second. Let's let the people transition. Bless you.
Good morning.
Morning,
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Michael Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 12 items on your agenda. Two are hand-carried, and we are withdrawing item 7IT. I have agency representatives available to answer questions on the remaining items.
Okay. Okay. In the days long ago when I was still practicing law, and a deposition I would often ask if a person had been taking medications that day, whether you're feeling well enough to answer questions truthfully and honestly and understand the gravity of the situation. So I know that you're probably on pain relievers of some sort today. And also, as the chair of the Opioid and Heroin Task Force, I caution you on how much of these wonderful medications you're using. They're for a short period of time, and be careful if you feel that you're still in pain after a while. Talk to your physician, and by all means, go to Advil or other items across the counter, Tylenol. Okay. I have a question on, I want to start with 3IT. This is the data center co-location, Tier Point, Maryland data center.
Yes, sir.
Sole source contract, which is larger than the original contract. And basically a 200% increase Can you tell me why you didn't just bid this out? Are there no other data centers around?
The simple answer is that we have utilized the Tier Point facilities, and our utilization has grown in such a way that under this contract there had been the expectation that their new facility would come online and be part of this. We are looking at utilizing the cloud far more than we have in the past. And rather than undertake contractual obligations, there are no other data centers that are central to Maryland to fulfill this use. We determined that based on the existing contract and their new facilities, this was the most appropriate model as we transition to a hybrid model and a cloud model.
How long do you anticipate the transition? This is a 5-year contract.
I expect the growth of the use of data and our use of the network facilities and the data center will continue throughout the 5 years, and this will act as a disaster recovery and a backup to systems as we move more and more of our systems to the cloud.
Okay. Now, last week when we were going through the heat wave burning through my heart, it's like the old song. I guess no one remembers that. Is that the Marvelettes? I don't remember. That the Comptroller's data center was shut down for a short period of time. Are we transitioning that data center as well to commercial data centers or cloud-based?
But there is no plan specifically to do that at this time, although we have certainly looked at that opportunity and expect to do that at some point in the future, but it is not currently on our agenda.
Okay. So the reason for not rebidding was that you like what Tier Point is doing and you feel they can handle it, but you also said there was no other data centers in the region? Is that?
There are technical issues with latency and other relationships in terms of how we are currently running our servers in their facilities that would make it not cost-effective to move to another data center in the interim, because our utilization is continuing to increase.
Uh-huh.
And we would effectively need multiple data centers for a 2 to 5 year period. And
okay.
It made more sense economically and from a technological standpoint to continue to work with the folks from Tier Point, because when this contract was originally let, they had already stated as part of their bid that they were going to be moving forward with their new facility in Laurel, which we took to provide us with additional access.
Parts of Laurel are in a floodplain. So
to my knowledge, the data center is not, sir.
Okay. Parts of it.
Yes.
Floodplain. So, okay. Well, a little bit later, and when you're feeling better also, we'll talk more detail about the data center concept and just the fact that I'll have to take your word on the competition. I just, would think there are more data centers that are in the area that we could utilize. When you say the legacy side, is it the fact that we're running a lot of our application on COBOL, so we have to open the gate at the old folks' home to get the programmers to come in? So, okay.
That's truer than most folks know, sir.
No, I'm quite sure it is, because COBOL's been gone a long time. So anyone under 50, or probably 55, never saw COBOL. Okay.
Could I just add, I was going to ask the same question, Mike, and I hope sometime in the near future we can have a discussion here of what your vision is.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a major...
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, I think everyone recalls back in 2012 the president mandated that the federal government was going to move everything to the cloud, and it was, cloud now. Well, last year we suddenly changed that policy federally, and it's now cloud smart, because there there are significant economies based on how one sets up different systems. You don't necessarily want all of your computing power occurring in the cloud. And so we are looking at optimizing those for the state and looking at our needs, you know, not just over the next 5 years, but 20 years out. So happy to have those discussions.
Okay. How many data centers do we actually operate, the state, that is?
Well, at this point, that's a very interesting...
Not the commercial ones, but...
Right. Well, that's a very interesting question on how we're going to define a data center. We have a significant data center in College Park.
Okay.
And then we have other facilities at various agencies that I would define as a data center for that agency. They might call it a computer room, but if there are a number of servers there and it is cooled and operating on the network, it operates as a data center. And, Steve, operationally, how many do we have currently? That are significant.
Yes.
Yeah. But other agencies...
But you have agencies that have...
MDOT has significant, yeah.
Okay, and there are probably other,
you know,
what I call bootleg data centers where they have a couple of servers in a room with an air conditioner blowing
right.
real hard.
Well, and
you know, a person sitting out front with a heater. That's what we had in when I was at the Department of Agriculture, and we were shutting down these bootleg data centers because every manager wanted their computer outside their office, their IT person, and it just was... You know,
well,
from a security
standpoint,
but also an energy standpoint.
Right. Well, as you know, we've had significant success in finding a number of servers that weren't part of our official network, and that we've been either incorporating them into the network or shutting them down.
Okay. That can be a big security issue.
Absolutely.
You know, because there could be the back doors. We see the ransomware. We see other things that take place. Okay. Thank you on that. I know we have a big question on your hand carry. I do want to ask about 7IT, which is public safety telecommunications.
That has been withdrawn, sir.
Oh, okay.
Whatever questions.
All right. I didn't listen well. I was engaged in your help. Okay. All right. The hand carry item, I know there are some questions. Madam Treasurer, you may have.
I have a number of questions
okay.
about items 11 and 12. They have a long history, and I'm afraid that a lot of the questions we've had over the past several months have still not actually been answered, but I wonder if you have somebody who wants to present before we start raising questions about it.
Well, I'd rather just jump into the questions. As you said, there is a considerable history to this item, and the principal reason I am here today, even though the Lieutenant Governor, fearful for my health, thinks I'm crazy, is because there has been considerable disagreement about some of the facts. And what I did not want to have occur today was that there would be further controversy because someone who wasn't directly engaged or involved in the discussions was attempting to talk about it. So I thought it was important enough that I climb out of my sick bed and come out to talk about this today because I agree with you that there are some significant issues here. We have... expended considerable resources at DOIT attempting to answer the questions that have been raised. And we have considerable record that in our attempts to address the issues have not been discussed outside of our meetings. So, you know, to the extent there are specific questions, the more transparency, the better, because I'd like to get on with making this work for everyone. And, as you raised the issue last fall about the transaction model, we are in agreement with you that the accounting for that particular model should have been revised and was immediately. and that the audit of the transaction model transactions, all of them, during the operating period, was done by an outside third-party firm, and there were no material findings, and the audits proved. So the concerns that had been raised that there was something amiss or that there was mis or malfeasance incurred, I think should be put to rest. And as you've stated before, the key to all of this is to provide the best services we can, most effectively, economically, and efficiently for the citizens of the state.
Okay, well, let me say, first of all, I don't think there have ever been allegations of fraud or misconduct.
Well, someone raised that with me the other day. That's why I came today.
No, I'm at this venue, and among us, there has never been such an allegation.
Okay.
So I just want to make that
clear. You and I have not had any such
discussions. For the record, absolutely. But this is an issue, and it's not just the Treasurer's office, Mr. Secretary. You seem to think it is. But more than a year ago, let me go back. This is a contract that the Board of Public Works approved, the contract with the NIT USA, to provide services to the public starting in 2011. And the contract that was before the board in 2011 and the presentation of your department to us in 2011 was that it was essentially self-funded. That is, a person who wanted to get a license to hunt or whatever sort of license they wanted would be able to go on an electronic portal and purchase a license electronically and pay a fee for that service the same way he or she would pay a fee anywhere, that there was no cost to the state. And by the way, when we say state, we obviously mean taxpayers, because we're not like the federal government. We don't print our own money. So there's no cost to the state. And that was the discussion, and that was the contract, and it was swell. And it went along that way for a while. And then apparently there was a change of heart, and the agencies decided, or someone decided, that they didn't want fees out there. They wanted the state, the taxpayers, to pay for the services instead. And that went on for a while, and now we are at this point, and you agree that that was not what was presented to the board originally, and you agree that in order to understand, in fact, what the transactions were, how much the taxpayers paid, how much the merchants, this company got for its services, you need to do some sort of audit. And there was a meeting last June with representatives of the Board of Public Works, not the Treasurer's Office, Board of Public Works and your department, and everybody agreed that an audit should be performed. And in order to know how much was spent, and therefore, by the way, how much to project if we're going forward, there would have to be an audit of the transactions. Everybody agreed with that. Your department contacted our department in September or October to make sure exactly what would be required in that sort of an audit and acknowledged that that's what they were going to do. But we still haven't seen that. The staff hasn't seen it. We certainly haven't seen it. And the concern is that we don't know how much actually has been spent without a clear audit of those transactions. We've had an audit of the company. It's very interesting. It's a very good company. The audit was quite good. But we haven't had an audit of the transactions. And you need to know what the cost was in each of those transactions. There are many different licenses with different costs in different departments. In order to know what the taxpayers have paid, we've been given different numbers over time, and now in the next item, this is item 11, In item 12, we're asked to approve a contract going forward that incorporates item 11 and projects that it will cost about $4.5 million a year. But we really don't know because we don't know what was spent before. And I, for one, simply do not understand why we have gotten to this point. And as they point out, there are hundreds of millions of dollars of transactions. Apparently, they receive very little revenue for it. They give us numbers for the revenue, but again, there's no substantiation, so we don't know. So I am just very concerned how we can approve 11 without having that basic information.
May I address your statements?
Sure.
To begin, you suggested I agreed with certain things that I don't agree with. All right. What I had said was that it is my belief and my understanding of accounting that providing a netting of fees, which is what the problem was that was raised, is inappropriate because we do not know what the actual transaction fee impact was on the permitting fee or the licensing fee or whatever. If you're only remitting the net fee, we do not have a complete picture of the transaction and the costs associated with it. So that's what was repaired. All right. The second point is I, with all due respect, and I've practiced law for 35 years, I read this contract and the documents associated with it very differently, and I'm happy to provide the board copies of all of the documents from early on in the discussions with the Executive Steering Committee, of which your personnel participated, of the approvals of how things were to be operated, and there are significant reports that demonstrate that your office was not only aware of the possibility of using transaction fees and also other services that were provided for free, but was part of those decisions. So to say, you know, in 2018 that this was something that was completely out of the scope of the contract and not within the purview of the steering committee folks involved with it, I take exception to. The other piece of this that you raise is that we have worked diligently at DOIT. I could provide you reports of man hours of my subject matter expertise and my senior staff that have taken time away from other important matters to attempt to address the issues that were arisen with regard to what the audit was to provide. The request for the audit, we were told by more than one outside auditing firm, was unreasonable to audit specifically 600 million transactions and physically impossible. And we have discussed that. So what we asked to occur was that all of the transactions that incorporated transaction fees be audited. And my understanding is your folks said that was not acceptable. You still wanted all 600 million transactions over the last 8 years incorporated into the audit.
Can I interrupt just for a moment?
Please.
You keep looking at me and saying my folks. I assume you're looking at everybody.
I'm looking
here
at
because
everyone.
It was
absolutely
the Board of Public Works, not the State Treasurer's Office.
Well, okay. The concerns that were raised were raised from your staff, and it may have well been purely on behalf of the Board of Public Works, and I will certainly accept that. My concern here goes to the fact that the audit that was requested was impossible. We provided an audit of all of the transactions utilizing the transaction model, and the Board of Public Works, for whatever reason, decided not to enter into an agreement to read the audit report that was provided. And so I've seen the report, and as I said, it says there are no material issues with regard to all of the transactions incorporating the transaction fees. I am happy to share that with you, but obviously we have to sign off to the auditor that it will remain in confidence and not be distributed elsewhere, as was our agreement with them.
Is that because there's proprietary information?
Yes. Yes. I share your concern. I believe that the accounting of these sorts of transactions should be absolutely transparent, and the netting of fees is clearly inappropriate. So we changed that the minute I was informed that that was occurring. And
so we got a lot of information, and apparently there's something now that none of us can see. I'm dumbfounded.
I guess we would have to sign the non-disclosure.
That's correct. We received a non-disclosure statement for me to sign on behalf of the board on Monday, that the report would be available Monday night. It had language in the acknowledgement for me to indemnify the auditor and for me to have the thing go according to laws of the state of New York. So I immediately said I would not sign it just on my own because of those two things. It came back on Tuesday. It had the indemnification paragraph taken out and now said the laws of the state of Maryland. I looked at it and did say that if it was disclosed to the board, it was not to be discussed. Also that the board would find the procedures sufficient for their use and all. So I distributed to your offices and I asked that the board would, board members individually would endorse me signing it, and I did not receive endorsements for me to sign it. Then one of the board members, and I think that board member could then sign it themselves. I did not want to sign it on behalf of the board. And it was something that was only prepared Monday night / Tuesday morning.
Could I just add, I appreciate the treasurer and her team and the governor's team and everybody looking at this issue, because I think it's much broader than just this audit issue. We're being asked to retroactively approve $11.7 million in additional funds to a contract with, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, NIC USA, for e-government services for the state, including online payment processing. So this was billed. I mean, the treasurer mentioned that we approved the original contract back in 2011. And two of us were here. And let me just quote, Mr. Secretary, because I really exempt you from some of this problem and mess that we have right now. But back in August of 2011, your predecessor, DeWitt Secretary Elliot Schlanger, said before this board, and I quote, "The beauty of the self-funded model is it is done without any cost to the agencies of the state." So here we are 8 years later, $11.7 million later. I guess we can say this contract is far from self-funding. In fact, state agencies have taken millions of dollars out of their agency accounts to subsidize the cost of taxpayers accessing their services using credit cards online. We all do that all the time. And I don't really argue with that policy. I can see why state agencies could, in effect, pay for the cost of citizens to purchase their services in a convenient fashion. What I'm concerned about here is transparency, accountability, and urgency. The board was flat out misinformed in 2011 when it was told that this contract would not cost the state a penny. In fact, unbeknownst to this board, not only were agencies racking up massive bills to the tune of millions of dollars, without this board's knowledge, the Department of Information Technology failed to bring the renewal options on this contract back to the board. So we have two major failures of transparency here. The board was misled when it originally voted to approve this contract, and the agency responsible allowed this contract to continue in place long after it should have expired in 2016. A related and no less serious issue is the issue of accountability raised by Treasurer Cobb. For the agency to stand before us today asking that we retroactively approve a payment amount it has been unable to say with 100% certainty is accurate is wrong. We're talking about more than $8 million at least in taxpayer dollars that agencies allowed this vendor to keep with no accountability. I've been informed there's a report, as mentioned, 19 months ago after this issue came to light, was finally made available to the board yesterday, clarifying all of this issue. I got lost a little bit in the weeds as it went back and forth. I'm obviously not going to sign any gag order or non-disclosure agreement. That's, I believe, completely inappropriate. So the conversation today has not really created any confidence on my part as far as accountability. I will say I'm glad to hear that as July of last year, we finally started keeping track of how much in state taxpayer dollars was going out the door, but clearly there were safeguards for the taxpayers that should have been put in place before that point, which brings me to the last point of urgency. Here we are at the last meeting before this contract expires. We're being asked to clean up a mess retroactively by blessing $11.7 million in spending, which, by the way, we don't know for sure if it's an accurate amount, and to approve a new contract with this vendor, or else citizens will be unable to pay for government services online. So those are three issues that I want to bring up. I want to compliment the treasurer. I know it's not easy for her and the staff and the board staff to get through all of the detail in this, but I think it's a very important issue that we're bringing up here. And I would actually suggest that we defer item 11 until the department comes back before the board and is 100% certain with the total amount the state has paid out to the company, to the vendor. That was one motion, and I would defer to the my colleagues on the board as to whether they want to support that or amend it. Additionally, I would propose an amendment to item 12. I would move that the board modify the contract term to 1 year with 1 6-month renewal option because there's absolutely no reason in my mind why we need more than a year to competitively bid this procurement. I think that's the most reasonable amount we've gotten from looking at other contracts like this around the country. And then if there's a 6-month period of phasing in, should the incumbent lose, I can see a 6-month extension renewal option. That might be unnecessary if the incumbent wins the new bid. But I would offer those two amendments as a what path to go forward. But I'll defer to the treasurer because she really has led the way on this, and I salute her and her staff.
But Mr. Comptroller, may I add to the discussion before you discuss the motions, because
sure.
You've raised a couple of points that I think additional information may be of value to the board. The first point you mentioned was that, excuse me, the two extensions of the contract were brought forward without going to the board, and that is correct. My understanding of both of those extensions was that they were listed as costing the state $40,000, which was well under the $200,000 threshold. And so on that basis, that's why they didn't go forward. It was not an attempt to undercut the process, because I agree with all the board members that transparency and accountability are terribly important. The second issue, though,
is... That was because they didn't include the transaction fees that the state was paying?
Yes, that's the case. The second point, though, I think is more important, and it goes to the comptroller's underlying question about what this contract is actually about. And what has caused our concern is the methodology of accepting payments or paying for various services. This is not merely a payment gateway. Just as, you know, Mr. Comptroller, the numerous systems that your office utilizes with IBM is dependent on IBM's proprietary technology. Right? You couldn't just end those contracts because of a payment gateway. You would have to replace the underlying technology. And what this contract actually entails is that this particular vendor has, over the last 8 years, provided the infrastructure and the applications and the service desks and the methodology for how much of the state's important day-to-day business gets done. And for us to replace the systems that the Department of Transportation is reliant upon would take more than 6 months. If this contract ends, we will have to rebuild all of those applications ourselves, either through new procurements or through our own resources. And so what I want to be very certain we're clear about is this contract is not merely a payment gateway contract. It is for actual application and software services that we are not in a position today to immediately rebuild without substantial restructuring of both the budgetary and the resources of the agencies involved.
Okay, let me ask, can you rebid this and get us a competitive bid within a year?
Well, what I have been informed...
I think it would be good to talk to Bob Gleason, who is, you know, our senior procurement executive. From the standpoint, generally speaking, and I know he hasn't looked at this particular application, but, you know, we just went through the bidding of the new EMMA system, which required a lot of coordination and implementation and connecting with existing systems in terms of the time often associated with rebidding a major information technology. If you can come up, you continue, but I want to hear from Bob.
I'll put you in the middle.
And Mr. Comptroller, in a vacuum, yes, I think this probably could be done in a year. The issue is that what we are suggesting in the sole source contract, which is not an extension of the existing contract, we have incorporated a number of new accounting terms, a number of new reporting terms to address what we see as the weaknesses and the problematic phases of the prior contract, is that it is going to take at least 6 months for the vendor working with us to come up with a transition plan in the event that we are not going to move forward with them. I've spoken to Sachin Bhatt, our procurement officer, and although we have spent considerable effort on looking at rebidding this contract, I actually wanted to have it done by now so that we would be moving forward with a new contract at the end of this contract rather than talking about other methodologies to keep services running. Simply, we haven't had the resources between our attempts, as we've said, to address the concerns for the audit, the new EMMA system, which is working grandly, and people leaving our procurement office. We just have not had the resources to complete an RFP. And Mr. Bhatt, as my subject matter expert, has told me that this is an 18-month to two-year process. So I'll leave it to Bob to speak to that. But I'm relying on what folks who know how to do this day in and day out have told me is the likely timeline. And the last thing I want to do is underassume what's necessary and create a scramble again at some point in the future.
Bob, if you can just talk to generally what it takes to procure and then implement a major system conversion, and you can base it on EMMA, which is probably a little less complicated than I think with the NIC system because of the user interface that takes place with NIC. If you can just talk generally about implementing a major system like this.
Certainly, yes. Good morning. For the record, my name is Bob Gleason, Senior Procurement Executive. I hadn't given any thought to this particular set of requirements until 2 minutes ago. But there's an old expression in procurement that if you want it bad, you'll get it bad. The question is, what is the timeline? What's the scope? What are the set of requirements? Who are the stakeholders? And it takes time to sort of draw a fence around what the need is and who it impacts, how it impacts them. So to just put a 12-month calendar timeline on that, absent knowing all of the facts that are in play in this procurement, It seems a little arbitrary to me, but once we know what the need is and what the set of requirements and the stakeholders and how to meet their needs, what the market looks like in terms of the suppliers who can provide this type of service, then we can begin to fashion a timeline. 18 to 24 months sounds more reasonable to me in terms of the type of, I'm presuming this is a software as a service set of applications. So how mature the market is for this in terms of the providers and whether Nix is the only one or there's other players in this, presuming that there are, I would probably ask for more than 12 months to be able to do that.
Okay, so here's what
and we're not even
I can hear all this, but I'm going to stay at 12 months. I don't think there's any reason why we can't competitively procure new services or the approval of the incumbent in a year. I think that's perfectly reasonable based on the fact that if the incumbent loses and there's a new vendor that's chosen after a year and there's a implementation phase-in rather than a six-month renewal option, I would amend that to make it 2 6-month renewal options. But I'm going to defer to the treasurer because she's the expert in all of this, and her staff has raised the issue, and I appreciate it. But I think the way forward is to, this would be for item 12. I think the way to move forward is one-year mandate to get us some competition and then 2 6-month renewal options if there's a new vendor.
Hold on, sir.
I think it would be prudent to, and I don't have a problem with the one-year term, mm-hmm. to get going with a new procurement, but I wouldn't, rather than the 2 6-months, just make it a year. They're already saying 24 months, 18 to 24 months, and with the renewal option that we mandate that they come back in if they need that additional year. Now, understand, most of our contracts are done that are set up are termination at by convenience of the state. So even though it's a one-year option, does not mean that if they get it all done in, 1 year plus 8 months, they can terminate the contract and move forward with a new vendor. I just don't want to give them that. I don't want to be in the situation where we're really holding them hard fast to 18 months, and then they have to prepare to come back to talk about this all over again for another few months.
It's perfectly reasonable.
1 year option. To get this, implemented.
Let me re-amend this very fluid amendment again. But I think that makes sense. But once again, I'm going to defer to the treasurer as to what she thinks is.
If I could add one more thing. Mr. Comptroller's correct in terms of what you mentioned earlier about the implementation. Getting the procurement is one thing. And then transitioning and implementing over beyond the procurement is a different matter. So that is more of a project management piece that needs to be designed as well, in addition to the procurement piece.
Then will move, and unless the treasurer wants to change it. Does that make sense?
May I add one small piece to this that I hope gives the board some comfort? One of the matters that was discussed over the last several days that I was very much in favor of was that there be regular reports to the board about our progress on this matter. And that is in three areas. First, with regard to the actual RFP or other process going forward to make sure that these services are still provided. And then secondly, as Mr. Gleason just stated, the project implementation aspects and timeline and costs associated with that ahead of time. And I'm distressed this has become such a huge issue, because I share your fundamental belief in the need for transparency and accountability and want this to work to the benefit of the citizens of Maryland. So I think a one-year extension is still very aggressive, But if that is what the board determines is appropriate, we will do our best and report to you along the way if we think that is becoming inappropriate and impossible.
I would make that motion.
Could we just,
yes, sir.
I don't want to be a wet blanket, but and I think one year, if you think 1 year with a 1 year option would work, that's good with me. I mean, you know better than I what it's going to take, but the question is what it is that is going to happen. If we defer this contract.
11.
12 seems to incorporate 11. How does that work legally?
Well, it only incorporates it to the extent that it defines the work orders that have occurred under 11 to be continuously maintained under 12. It does not specifically incorporate a need to use the methodologies. I mean, we say the methodologies are the same, except for those that we have specifically changed. So we've referenced a change in how we're going to address.
If 11 is void or voidable, if it turns out there are problems with 11, which needs to be audited, I would like to ask our attorneys. I'm not a lawyer. Everybody else here may be lawyers. I just don't understand how we adopt 11 without recognizing the validity of. You're a lawyer.
David Bohannon for the record, counsel of the board. Thank you. The item 11 references the contract that there are concerns about whether it is void or voidable. That contract has an expiration date and will end as of that expiration date. Item 12 proposes a new contract with its own terms and conditions. Item 12 incorporates by reference many of the terms that are in the contract in item 11. It is a separate contract. It simply uses the document in item 11 as a shortcut for drafting. Frankly, it probably would have been better to draft it entirely, but the mere fact that it references it and incorporates it by reference is not a problem for the fact that it is a new independent contract.
So essentially becomes an appendix or an exhibit to a contract.
Correct.
And you say that this new contract is $4.5 million a year. That's based on...
That is based on what the transaction model services utilized over the past period have generated and the expectations based on those particular work orders continuing into the future. It is an estimate, and if the citizens of the state suddenly decide to use services dramatically more or dramatically less, it can have an impact on that number. But based on the practices over the period of time that they've been utilizing these transaction fees, that estimate is borne against the course of conduct during that period.
Well, let me say two things about that. First of all, you agree it is a guesstimate because we haven't dealt with 11, so we really don't know what the cost to the taxpayers is. And secondly, I have to take on faith, I guess, our attorney. Other attorneys have disagreed with whether you can vote.
Do you want to advise the Attorney General's office?
Yeah, I was looking for him. I didn't see him.
Well, Mr. Chason's here.
My attorney. Our attorney.
For the record, David Chason, counsel to the Treasurer.
Assistant Attorney General.
Assistant Attorney General. I would agree with David Bohannon. I think the cleanest thing to do would have been to just craft a new document that could even use the existing as a template. But I would also agree with Gabe Nile, who we spoke just before the meeting, is troubled by the fact that we have a void or voidable contract that we're incorporating by reference in a new contract.
And my response to that is we are only referencing it as a definitive way to lay out the terms. We have stated with specificity that the terms are the same, except those that we have clearly changed. This is a maintenance contract to operate what has been an ongoing contract that, but for the concern about the transaction fees arising, has worked well since 2011. Most of the operations are in the department of MDOT, and they have worked well. Although you do not have the audit in front of you, okay, I have signed the non-disclosure, and to the extent you are willing to take my testimony that the documentation says there are no issues, that the books proved out that the transaction fees down to the transaction level proved and are correct. It's unfortunate that you don't have that in front of you, but I've seen that. The letter from the auditors specifies that there are no material issues, and I believe that counsel would agree that although there may be difference of opinion about whether it's cleaner to incorporate terms from another document by making it an appendix or rewrite everything, it is still a practice that does occur with regularity. And my concern in doing this, because of the shortness of time, we had to craft a solution, because like you, I'd hope we would have gotten this done long ago.
I started a year ago, over a year ago.
It did. Because we didn't have it done sooner, we were looking at the cleanest, straightforward way to make sure that the new contract for maintenance of ongoing existing operations, except with regard to the transaction fee transactions, which we have laid out new processes and procedures for, continue without difficulty.
If I could just add, the only contract that I've seen in the backup is a four-page document, which you all were given as well. The contract documents that they referenced from 2011, I've not seen an unredacted copy of that contract, nor has it been provided to the board. I would suggest that we go back to the drawing board and draft the new contract, defer the item for 2 weeks, and vote on it at that point. That way we could review the contract, exactly what it says, and deal with any issues at that time.
It's my understanding the documentation has been provided to the board in the past. I don't know where Andrea is. And the other point here that I want to make sure is not lost is if we do not deal with this today, we will be in the situation that as of the 10th of August, we will be out of contract with NIC, and those services will stop. So the MBA will not
be able to. Could I just suggest something here? Right. First of all, I'm not going to vote to approve $11.7 million. Because there's no certainty that that's the correct figure. So that's why I think we should defer item 11 until you come back with a figure that you have confidence, not a guesstimate. And secondly, the item 12, I think I'm just going to hold my finger 1 year and I think the Lieutenant Governor made a good point. Instead of 2 6-month renewal, just have 1 12-month renewal option. That gives you time to competitively bid it. And then should there be a new vendor, it gives you 12 months to allow the new vendor to develop the platform that is necessary.
Well, it'll be hundreds of applications and a significant platform. My concern, to your point, is that I do have confidence because the audit report I have seen says there are no material.
Okay. We've gone through that. What I would like to do is.
No.
We're going to stop here. What I would like to do is take a vote on the comptroller's first motion to defer 11, and I will second his motion.
Could I just clarify? Defer 11 for what purpose?
Well, when they can come back, and one of the questions I would have is whether the accounting firm can redact that material that is proprietary. so that we don't have to have the non-disclosure portion. I mean, I'm not an accountant. I don't know all the provisions. I'm not sure what they were looking at. And, you know, I guess the question may be their pricing, but typically pricing is in a contract. When we approve a contract, the price that becomes known. So I'm not sure what can be done. So, you know, possibly they can redact whatever is particularly sensitive or confidential.
I think, sir, the confidential matters are their methodology that they're utilizing to prove that the...
Whose methodology? The accounting firm?
The accounting firm, yes. But we'll certainly pursue that.
Okay. Well, let's
Governor, I'd like to say I would agree with that motion on 11 if the understanding is, in fact, it's being deferred so that you will come back with an appropriately audited statement. But the sort of thing that we've been talking about for a year. Well, and if you could get with the staff of BPW, you've met with them before, you know what they're looking for, transaction-based fee audit, that's fine. If we're just deferring it because we're going to punt on it forever, I don't think that's appropriate.
Well, Madam Treasurer, I think the difficulty we have, and again, I am not an auditor, but what I have been told is that a request for a transaction-level audit on every single transaction, be it under the transaction fee model or the service fee model or the convenience fee model, is impossible based on the records that exist. And I've been saying that for a year. And so my attempts here have always been to address the specific concerns that have been raised with regard to the transaction fee. If what the board is asking for is an audit of all 600 to 800 million transactions that have occurred under this contract, I have been told that is physically impossible.
Well, the thing is, let's have the accounting firm tell us that in writing.
Well, they told me that, but I'll...
Well, they told you that, but they tell the board in writing, as well as investigate whether any of their, you know, their methodology can be redacted in a way that the board has confidence in their findings. So let's... So we have a motion on the table to defer this, to wait for additional information from the accounting firm, the auditing firm. So do we have a vote?
Yes. I vote yes.
Yes, yes, and yes. Okay, 3-1. The
but
second...
I hope, just as you're going to brief us repeatedly on everything, there will be an update on this issue.
Sure.
Because otherwise it's going to never be.
Absolutely.
Madam Treasurer, let me say it's outstanding now. It's deferred. Now, the board has not ratified. The board has done nothing. And in this item, they make a statement, DOIT, that this contract is void. And they need the board to make it voidable. What I'm saying is it's incumbent on them, absolutely. They should not, cannot be making this item to not come back to you for years, because the legislative auditor, the Board of Public Works, everyone will get on. Basically, this item is saying it's void. They have $11.9 million of state money,
right,
and you still need an accounting of it. So I can imagine that your deferral is not sending the message that you're not going to see this again sometime. It's a deferral for them to come back and make this.
And that certainly wouldn't be our intent,
right,
Madam.
Thank you for saying that on the record.
Okay. And then the second motion on 12 is amendment to 1 year and one option year. And I will second that motion. And do we have a vote?
Vote aye.
One aye.
Governor, I am very reluctant to do that without the terms of the contract, just through reference to a voided contract. So I'm going to vote no, but I do look forward to seeing the work go on. The people of this state should not suffer because of these problems we've had. And I hope that the new RFP can be successful. We look forward to hearing about it.
Thank you. Okay. Any other discussions on, I forgot who we were with, the Department of Information Technology?
I have to say this discussion has put some color in your cheeks.
Yes, you were looking very pale, but we both noticed that. So we need to vote for the other items.
Right.
So do we have a motion to approve the remaining items on the agenda? Okay. And a second on that. And so I think we're all in favor of the remainder of the do-it items.
If I could recognize Margaret Phipps, who's one of the most popular and durable elected officials in the state of Maryland, in Calvert County. Margaret, welcome.
Oh, good to see you.
Yeah.
Natural Resources.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio, Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. We have 25 items on our real property agenda today for which we are seeking approval, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
I have a question on 10.
I just wanted to mention, I don't know which item it is.
Park.
Yes, it's item 8A2.
Yes.
Do you know item 8A2, Madam Secretary?
Yes.
It's the Edith Throckmorton Park. And I just would like to state for a record, completely different topic. Edith Throckmorton was a woman whom I met when I first came to Montgomery County, a fascinating and wonderful woman. And I think it's just terrific to have this item. Let me just take 2 minutes to make... Do you remember Edith? All right. Edith Throckmorton was an African-American, brilliant teacher and principal in the Montgomery County Public Schools. She was principal of Longwood when it was a segregated school. She was a teacher and, as I recall, and this is all based on memory, a teacher and principal for a few decades, and one of the very best in Montgomery County. And when the schools were integrated after Brown v. Board, the way in which our county integrated our schools was to close down the traditionally black schools, move the students and integrate the traditionally white schools, and to move the teachers and the principals. And lo and behold, all of the principals, I believe all of them, were asked to become teachers under the white principals in the formerly white schools, now integrated schools. Some of these principals were like Edith Throckmorton. She had been outstanding. Everyone agreed she was outstanding. And she was moved to serve under a younger white principal, and she refused. And despite her love of the school children and of our school system, Principal Edith Throckmorton resigned from the Montgomery County school system as a matter of principle. She then went back to the county and was the driving force for creating our Commission on Human Relations and served on that commission, and then went in and essentially took over Montgomery County NAACP, which is where I first met her, when she became a strong leader for a couple of decades after that. She was a woman who acted always on principle, but didn't just walk away either. She came back in another way and moved her county and moved her school system, and generations of students still talked about her. And to raise her name in a great project like this is just, I think, something that all the citizens should know about, which is why I have entered this into our public record, a tribute to a great lady.
Thank you very much. That's
thank you, Madam Treasurer.
Very enlightening.
Yeah.
That instance, in the years after Brown versus the Board of Education, that story is not uncommon. Most of the schools that had been segregated were shut down in areas. In Howard County, the same thing occurred, and the principals were demoted. Many of the principals were holders of PhDs, and they just—it's
she was a woman
part of our history.
Several college degrees. I mean,
right.
Just outstanding.
Right. Okay. Well, very good. I have a question on item 10A, and it's a purchase of property in Queen Anne's County. And looking at the appraisals, there's a substantial difference between the appraised values of the property. One is $763,000, and the other is $397,000. And I just wonder the significant difference in those appraisals.
Yes, sir. So I'm by no means an expert on real estate appraisals, but what I do understand and what we have noticed over time is that with various properties, particularly when we're talking about easements versus acquisitions, it can be really difficult to appraise them. And the areas that we usually have the most discrepancies are first, finding comps that are comparable, and then two, the highest and best use of the property, depending on the appraiser that is conducting the appraisal. So in this case, the two independent appraisers that were procured for this had very different ideas about what highest and best use might be for this property. And when our team reviewed the two independent appraisals, they agreed with the higher end, and they agreed with his assessment of what could potentially be highest and best use. And in this case, unfortunately, that meant five developable lots. So our acquisition price is under the recommended appraisal, which is a good news story, and also having this easement will prevent this from going to development.
So the belief is that the lower appraisal, he did not include the development potential for that property? It was zoned that it could be developed?
Yes, sir. I think the difference was that the appraiser who had the lowest appraisal was looking at access and roadway frontage and thinking that there was less of a chance that these lots might become developable. And the appraiser that came out at the higher end was looking at the county overall and development pressure overall in that region. I would also just point out that this isn't a targeted ecological area for us. It scored very high on our program open space scorecard. It was a 90 out of 100. And, you know, this is really significant when it comes to protecting water quality for the Corsica River watershed.
Okay. I mean, there's something very similar in the next item that's in Somerset County, where there's a substantial difference between the appraisals, the same appraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And is it the same argument here?
Yes, sir, it is.
Development potential versus non-development potential?
Yes, so the lower appraised value in this instance was based on small unimproved lots. That's what was used for the comps. And the higher end appraisal, again, looking at highest and best use, was reviewing improved lots that were recently sold. And again, in this case, we did acquire the property under the higher assessed value.
Okay. Now, I know I have a particular bias, and that is, amongst others, that at one time, and the reason for, you know, procurement rules is to separate the individual that loves the item from the person who will make a more cold, dispassionate decision. And in the olden days, this separation, this type of purchase, was actually done by the Department of General Services. And I admit a bias there. But I do go back to that dispassionate viewpoint. You know, your business is to protect property, and so the bias of DNR is to love every property and to say we will pay what they ask for it, or $3,000 less in one case. And so I just point that out, because then, you know, when I see this kind of divergence, you know, it's basically you had one appraiser who's appraising based on apples and the other is appraising based on oranges. So it then goes back to a DNR person who says maybe it's all, you know, dispassionate and saying that this is the right value. Or the possibility is there is that this is a very important piece of property, let's pay for the asking price. So I say that as an editorial comment, with full disclosure that as a former General Services Secretary, I do see the value of the arm's length transaction that someone who is not invested in the property can say this is something that we can drive a harder bargain on. But I think the immediate would be to talk to the appraisers to make sure that they are appraising based on a same set of criteria. That may not be as reasonable if one person just, you know, adamantly believes it can't be developed and the other is looking more globally, like in the case of Queen Anne's County. But in the case of Somerset, you know, they're looking at different comparables. So I'm not sure how that is addressed. But I'm not going to, you know, object. I just wanted to put in that editorial.
Can I just ask, how much does it cost to have an appraisal?
That's a good question. Heidi, do you have... I'd like to ask Heidi, our Director of Land Acquisition, to come up.
Heidi Dover, Department of Natural Resources. It depends. It varies on the size of the property, and the complexity can be anywhere from a couple thousand dollars up to $15,000 or $20,000.
Say something like item 11. I mean, a small, relatively small.
That's
the
Chesapeake
Forest Lands Tract.
My question really is, does it ever become prudent to have a third appraisal?
We do often. In item 10, we did have a third appraisal that was not accepted by our chief review appraiser based on methodology. There was not sufficient support.
So a third acceptable appraisal.
Yes. So for those first two appraisals, he found the methodology to be acceptable in both of them. It's just that, as the Secretary said, one appraiser, they actually, I think, did find the same highest and best use. One appraiser just found that there would be five developable lots, and the other appraiser said because of the lack of the road frontage, the reality, there's the theory of development, which is five developable lots, the reality is that because of the lack of that access, they probably would not ever be developed or developable. And that's just the difference between the point where a county zones and the point when development actually occurs.
Goes back to my editorial comments.
Yeah.
So that said, I think that's an excellent suggestion, Governor, to maybe speak with the Real Estate Appraisals Association and see if we can find a way to improve these processes. As I said, it does become very difficult, particularly with these easements and acquisitions of very unique properties. It's not always as straightforward as a commercial building or a simple residential real estate transaction. So I appreciate that recommendation and we'll definitely look into that.
All right. So, okay, something we can look at in terms of also structure of government as well.
I had another question about some of these and also the Forest Service projects. Is there a time when you factor in the impact of climate change and greenhouse gas mitigation when we're looking at not only procuring but using the forest land?
Yes, we do. Through the CoSmart program, we do an evaluation based on the mapping that I know you're familiar with, thanks to your service on the Climate Change Commission. We do include that in our evaluations, and we are measuring the potential for mitigation, working with the Department of the Environment for greenhouse gas reduction, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act plan.
In the lands that we either procure or own already?
In the lands we procure, as well as the lands that we manage, because you can actually manage forests to better mitigate and sequester greenhouse gases. So our team is very, very conscious of that, and we've really integrated that policy into our operations.
Good. Thank you.
Sure.
Any questions, additional questions on the Department of Natural Resources?
Move approval.
Okay, all in favor? Okay, thank you. All right. Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, Mark Nicole, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Budget Management. The Department has submitted 10 items for your consideration today. We are withdrawing item 1S, leaving 9 items for approval. We have representatives here for to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Mr. Comptroller?
Item 3S, please.
Dana Dembrow.
Excellent.
Dennis Schrader.
Great. For the record, Dennis Schrader, Chief Operating Officer, Medicaid Director for the Health Department, and I'm joined by Dana Dembrow and Rebecca Frischard, our Deputy Director for Behavioral Health.
Thank you for being here. This is a 5-year, 4-month contract with 1 2-year renewal option for administrative support organization services to support the work of the public behavioral health system. It's a $198 million contract. It appears that the incumbent submitted a financial proposal that was 20% higher or $72.1 million more than the recommended awardee, United Behavioral Health. Obviously, I love bid competition. This is fabulous that you have it in front of us. I applaud the progress that were made in what I used to call the incumbent protection program of just contracts going back to the original incumbent vendors without any other bids. So thank you for getting 2 bids. However, I always do, when I see these contracts where there's a lucrative contract for years and years, and it's substantially less than the incumbent, I think it's appropriate to raise a red flag because we've had problems in the past, and I don't have to regale the board about Crystal Enterprises, the debacle that took place in a previous administration. But the principle remains the same, that the incumbent, in theory, should have some rough idea of how much the services would and should cost. So I understand United Behavioral Health is the largest private behavioral health insurance provider. I'm not, however, seeing a lot of places where they provide this type of administrative service organization services on behalf of governments. I note that they currently do this for San Diego, California. I think they used to do it for New York City, but are you confident that United will be able to do the job satisfactorily with the financial proposal price it submitted?
Mr. Comptroller, Governor, Treasurer, I asked the same question, and so we did a lot of due diligence on this.
Just a couple of thoughts. And by the way, we like the current contractor. So, you know, it's not that we're unhappy with them. But there is a process, and we're dispassionate about the process. We let the facts speak for themselves. So one of the basic things that we looked at is what is the current baseline contract that we're paying for? And then we've also added additional services to the contract or additional scope. The current contract was 3 years with 2 one-year options with a spend rate of about $20 million a year, rough and ready. The total expenditure after 5 years was about $93 million. So we knew that was a floor that we were basing against. We did an estimate beforehand to determine what we thought the prices would be, and we came up with about $27 to $30 million a year based on the scope that we had added to the base contract. The Optum bid, which is a subsidiary of United Healthcare, came in at about $27 million per year, and Beacon came in at $37 million a year. We are a little mystified by why that is, but we are very confident. And I would add that the successful bidder was the number one technical bid. So when we went through the technical parts of the bid process, Optum was also number one. So we've got a really good price for the number one technical proposal, and we feel that this is going to get the job done. And there is money in there, an additional $7 million per year for the additional scope that we've added to the project.
Okay, let me just get to the heart of what I'm concerned about.
Yes.
There was a recent lawsuit against United Behavioral Health. That's from the company's practices in its core insurance business.
Mm-hmm.
So this is earlier this year, a March article in the New York Times, quote, in a scathing decision released Tuesday, a federal judge in Northern California ruled that a unit of United Health Group, the giant health insurer, had created internal policies aimed at effectively discriminating against patients with mental health and substance abuse disorders in order to save money. I'm going to spare all the particulars of that decision, but I can assure you they're just as bad as you can imagine from that language from a federal district court judge. So I do have a confidence problem that this company can perform these services for 20% less than what the incumbent would charge. But can it also give you assurances that this more than $70 million in savings will not be achieved through inappropriate restrictions on access to care?
If I could address that.
Yes.
That's a great question, and it goes to the heart of the system of care that we have in this state. 25 of the 50 states have carved in behavioral health, and that's where, in this case, the situation you're citing is where managed care organizations are carved in with the behavioral health. And you'll hear from that behavioral health community in this state, they have a lot of concern about that. As a matter of fact, we've organized a very intense process that's going to go over the next 2 years to look carefully at this, because the managed care organizations in this state have been pushing for that model. And we also, of our 9 managed care organizations, United happens to be one of them. Setting that aside, the model we currently have as the administrative services organization is they organize the providers and they pay the claims. They have no incentive, financial incentive. They're providing strictly a service to us. They are unable to deny service in the way that a managed care organization, and that is a common issue around the country with managed care organizations. So, yes, sir. We're confident
so
that our
ASO.
So
what exactly is administrative service organization services? What exactly are they?
So we have about 260,000 people who receive specialty behavioral health in the state, so that they're all obviously Medicaid. Some are state-only funded, but Medicaid pays for the lion's share, and it's about total $1.4 billion, $1.2 billion Medicaid, $200 million in non-Medicaid. What the Administrative Service Organization does is they have an automated process of all the providers in the state. The providers submit their claims. They do the due diligence on the claims to make sure they're appropriate, and then they send them to our Medicaid Management Information System, which we then pay the claim. They also help us with assessments of quality, and we're going to be adding more of that type of thing to this new contract. So they are not incentivized in any way in this to financially make money by restricting access.
Okay, that's excellent. I have a lot of confidence in you and obviously former Delegate Dembro. I have a lot of confidence in him. But would you make sure that someone reads that federal district court judge?
We will.
And just keeps an eye on...
Yes, sir. And it's a very legitimate concern. We had the same question, so we appreciate
the opportunity
to answer. Thank you.
Any other questions on budget and management agenda?
Move approval.
Second. All in favor? Budget management. Okay. Thank you. University System of Maryland. Friends in Canada call it Maryland. The kids snickered when we were in Canada. Tour guide said Maryland.
Good afternoon, Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 8 items on the agenda. Here to ask any questions.
More of a comment on 7C option. Two comments. One is thank you for putting in the Small Business Reserve Program. It's on-call contract for minor general contracting services. But the second is similar to what I was saying to transportation a little earlier, that hitting the projects or limiting the project size to $200,000 on these contracts, I think, is very small. And I think that the small businesses that are in the Small Business Reserve, particularly the construction and contracting companies, they can and have done work higher than that. So I'd encourage you to encourage your contracting officers to look at providing Small Business Reserve projects and contracts that have a higher threshold so that these companies can go further than the $200,000 if they can just take a look at that.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions on the university system?
Just a request, not a comment, that in the Salisbury project, which looks extremely interesting, could you get back to us, because I am told it's a little early to ask this question, about the energy savings and how you're going to go about specifically, and this goes for all of the projects, actually, but you often do give us information, which I appreciate. This one had not.
Madam Treasurer, that information was passed to the procurement officers from the last board meeting. And so,
okay, great.
It's been made
clear. Keep pushing. Thanks, Joe. Okay.
Move approval.
Okay. We're all in favor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Who do we have left now? General Services, I think. Right? Since we skipped over. Okay.
Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Nelson Reichert, Deputy Secretary of the Department of General Services. The department has 41 items on our agenda. We are withdrawing item 32 GL. We'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
I have a question on 2C Mod. This is the district court building. And it relates to the change order that was put in place with regard to the stud gauges. Shouldn't this have been discovered in the design?
It was a double entry in the design. It was picked up in one and not changed in a later one. We are going back and seeking correction on it.
When you say seeking design, correction, to see if there's some right. way of offsetting these costs?
Yes.
Okay. That is, okay. Just a bit concerned when we see change orders coming in. So that was a...
Right.
How far along are they in the Cape Spill? I see it's been closed up. The building is closed.
Closed. I think we're looking probably December to finish up.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah. Is this DGS?
Yes.
Yes. I have an item 4MOPT. So, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford and Madam Treasurer, this is a request from the Department of DGS to exercise the second and last two-year renewal option on a contract with Mansfield Oil Company for the supply and distribution of fuel products. I believe this is a company down in Georgia. When this contract was first...
It was item four last year.
There we go. Okay.
This is, yes, you, there was
it's
a,
the item with two numbers. Two
it
names
is. It is 9M op. Last agenda was withdrawn as 4M, so it is the same item.
Okay. But when this same fuel contract was brought before the board for approval in 2012, I voted against the contract because I couldn't believe that not a single Maryland fuel supplier could legitimately compete for this award. I voted to renew the contract in 2017 with assurances from the department that, quote, the department intended to use the two-year renewal option period to assess whether the delivery and equipment maintenance components of the contract could be regionalized, which might draw interest from local Maryland businesses. It's my understanding, Mr. Deputy Secretary, that DGS, in fact, did not perform this review, as it indicated 2 years ago. I'm wondering why that is. Could you give us an explanation? Why the department failed to conduct the promised review?
A couple of reasons for that, Mr. Comptroller. One is we've had a pretty substantial changeover in our procurement unit with personnel, and it was sort of lost in the transitions. We did put out an RFP recently for a consultant to assist us in this, and the results of that RFP came back with not good proposals. We are prepared now to go put it back out on the street to hire a consultant to assist us in analyzing all aspects of this fuel management systems and delivery. We expect to put that out on the street. We actually had it ready and held off until Emma came on board so that we wouldn't get lost in that transition. We're going to expect to put it out probably in about a week to put out a new RFP for a consultant to assist us in evaluating, and specifically because of the questions you've asked, to go back and specifically study the Maryland market and see if there are operators that could compete on this contract. Whether they will or not, we can't say, but we're going to see if there are out there. I believe we have at least found one that has potentially indicated an interest in it that's local. So we're going to balance it.
Is that Carroll?
Yes.
Well, sure. And if you regionalize it, you can probably get more. We're talking diesel fuel.
We're talking bulk and, right.
Yeah. So this is not something that is foreign to Maryland-based businesses. It's just that for whatever reason, they can't, you know, get in here and compete for this. So thank you for saying that. It's what we heard 2 years ago. It's okay. I understand your discussion, but this is a single bid contract that I, with great pleasure, will vote against. Not because I'm a purist. I just think that we need to hold departments, Nelson, like yours, accountable for the commitments they make. And saying that, you know, you had some procurement problems. Why don't you borrow Stembro over there? He'll fix things over there.
Well,
yeah. And
So I don't mean to make light of it. I know how difficult these reviews are, and it's sometimes very hard. But this strikes me as something where the department dropped the ball, and I'm going to vote negative on the item and look forward to, I guess, a real review.
We intend to come back with a real review and look at the idea of getting more businesses, more Maryland businesses involved, although they have been heavily involved in this contract through delivery of maintenance and so forth. The new contract will not have as many components to it because it's strictly fuel. The last one had a lot of infrastructure work done, but we look at that and also look at the economies to the state of Maryland, to the taxpayers, in terms of the cost, as well as local businesses.
Okay. So if I could ask the county governor for this item to be voted separately, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. That's fine.
What happens if the item's voted down?
If the contract expires.
The contract expires, we will run out of gas. For state vehicles, trucks.
Let me ask this question in terms of the idea of the consultant. So the consultant's doing more than doing a market survey. Correct?
Right.
Okay. Now, I think what the comptroller is saying, that 2 years ago the agreement was to do basically a market survey, and he said DGS didn't have the capacity to do that. This is, my ongoing, pet peeve is, why didn't you ask the budget and management group, because they have management in their name? I'm quite sure they have analysts that they could assign, or somebody in another department to assign to do market research. They don't have to be a fuel expert to find out whether in the West there's a distributor, whether in the central part there's one or two distributors on the upper shore, lower shore, northeast. We can reach out to, some of our sister agencies that are working, but they can assign a person or two to do this. Now, the new, what you were just saying, is going to be more than a market research project, but if it was just market research, I think a non-expert but somebody who's thorough could do the work.
It is market research specific to the petroleum industry, not just to use the, people that have gas stations or
small
business.
No, I understand that. But
what we really need to delve into the petroleum industry's activities and not only gas prices, how they fluctuate, how to maximize the daily fluctuations of gasoline on the global market, and drill down to what we buy and how we can structure our contracts to track the maximum advantage of those fluctuations in the market, and how to buy and how to structure our operations to take all those things into consideration.
I understand, and I probably discount the value of consultants often, but it just seems to me that a couple of graduate students could do that, quite frankly, particularly if it's a 2-year project or in 2 years. But in any event, I'm not going to debate
that. If I could just echo, you have that pet peeve, which is totally legitimate. I have one too, about the fact that here we are on July 24th. The treasurer asked, I think, a cogent question, which is, what happens if we vote this down? Guess what? The contract that we're voting on today expires in a week. How can that be proper management practice if we're told that we have to exercise this option or we're going to run out of gas in a week? So there's my pet peeve.
I have another one, actually. In addition to those, there are approximately 120 fueling facilities throughout the state. We dispense about 11.8 million gallons per year. We are never going to make our greenhouse gas goals if we keep doing this, instead of moving the way MDOT says we're supposed to move, towards an electric vehicle infrastructure. And every time I raise this issue, somebody, some other department is the one that has to deal with it. You have two electric charging facilities, as I understand, one in Annapolis, one in Baltimore. 120 gas. I'd like to see the plan for moving that to. I'll vote for this because the comptroller's got dibs on voting against it. But I don't want you to think that, yeah, that we're supportive of what you're doing, because I'm not. I think you all have to get together and move before it's too late.
Well, I have a question, though, on the, you know, electric vehicle infrastructure, and this goes to, I don't think it's as much of a policy debate as it is just an economic debate. The state's, you know, fueling facilities are based on what the state fleet is. The cost of electric vehicles right now is extremely expensive unless you get the tax credit. Yeah. Unless you get the tax credit.
Actually, I don't believe
and the state
cycle,
does.
That's true, Governor.
But maybe the life cycle, we really don't know on the life cycle side.
I'm sorry but the Secretary is not here, because actually I'm echoing what the Secretary of Budget said only 2 weeks ago.
Well,
echoing with a little.
I don't know what his life cycle discussion was, but I think we really don't know, because they're relatively new in terms of the technology. But I'm just saying, from the standpoint of the cost, is still at that point where it is, you know, it's a little high for what we are doing in terms of the budget. I mean, there can be some places where they may be able to, but right now for, you know, law enforcement, for state highway, those are primarily the vehicles that are used. Now, there are some other, you know, state vehicles that, you know, Department of Natural Resources and some others have. And maybe for some of the, what you would call personal sedans, maybe there are possibilities there. But we have to really look at that cost associated with
that. Governor, all I can say is, I don't remember whether it was the last meeting or the meeting before, when we approved the traditional list of vehicles the DBM was suggesting. The new head of that branch, who is a former trooper, pointed out that, in fact, there is a great opportunity for using those electric or hybrid and
hybrid
saving money, as well as saving energy and reducing pollution in fact, the public safety fleet.
Well,
this is being done, and we have money that we got from the Volkswagen settlement. It's
well,
not
if
just
that's the one,
money.
If we, and that's a good
and
point.
What I'm saying is, it needs coordination, and
yeah,
somebody's got to decide whether we really mean it when we say we're going to reach these.
Well, I would be in favor of utilizing the Volkswagen money for that. I'm not sure how that's supposed to be distributed. We ought to talk to the Department of Environment on that.
I think there is a plan in the Department of Environment. The question is Department of General Services, Department of Budget, Department of Transportation, Department of Environment.
Right, right.
I don't want to leave out the Department of Natural Resources, but all of them. I mean, this is, and everybody wants to do the good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to get everybody together and do it. And meanwhile, these individual items pop up that ice us in, freeze us in, to the way it used to be. And I just,
well, that,
I
don't
know. Sure,
but we're not, you know, we're not frozen in. This is a 2-year extension of what we're currently doing, essentially.
Well,
I'd be willing to have that conversation with Department of Environment to better understand how the Volkswagen settlement funds can be used, what was agreed to, and how they can be used, so that you can use a portion of that to purchase either electric or hybrid or combination of the two. Hybrids, I don't think, and that's where I would want to pull some of it away to see if you can use the vehicles. Because you could get the infrastructure, but if we don't have the vehicles, That's different.
But
the hybrids are not a.
But if you don't have the infrastructure, you can't.
But you could do. You can do a combination of both. You're not going to be able to roll them all out at the same time. But you can add more of the facilities at the same time. You have vehicles that can go to the facilities. Okay.
Right.
So on I'm this
happy,
item,
I'm happy to add a few electric charging stations if I get a second vote.
Oh, you have the budget for that.
No, I'm, sir, Madam Treasurer, thank you for raising those issues, but I continue my concern here. And
well, we'll have a separate vote on, I think there was a motion to vote separately on 9M. I can second that motion. So in terms of the vote, I think the Treasurer has already stated she's voting aye. I'm voting aye, and the Comptroller has voted nay on that. Any questions on the remainder of General Services?
I just want to note for the record that item 18 is a lease renewal for my satellite office in Elkton. This is one of the Comptroller Agency's 12 regional branch offices across the state. They are among the agency's unsung heroes for their unwavering commitment to deliver respectful, responsive, and results-oriented customer service. I'm going to salute the Elkton branch office manager, Ronnie Johnson, and his great team, as well as Gary White and Dennis Gwynn, who serve as director and deputy director, respectfully, of my office's taxpayer services division. Obviously, I'm very proud and grateful for their great work, Lieutenant Governor, and appreciate your support and the treasurer on this particular item.
We were deferring that. Okay. No other questions on General Services. We have a motion to approve the remainder of
move approval.
I will, okay. We have a second. We're all in favor.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.